I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. By now, you've heard Anthony Scaramucci's profanity-laced tirade that he unleashed on The New Yorker's Ryan Lizza. He's out of a job as White House Communications Director, but his vulgar words live on.
And Ryan's his f***ing paranoid schizophrenic, paranoiac. What he's going to do is, maybe Bill Shine's coming. Let me leak the thing and see if I can block these people the way I blocked Scaramucci for 6 months.
But I wanted to ask you if you wanted to be profiled.
I don't want to be profiled.
Well, just
I'm
what
not
you're
Steve
trying
Bannon.
To do. What you're trying to do.
I'm not Steve Bannon.
No.
I'm not trying to my own. I'm not trying to build my own brand off the strength of the president.
Yeah, but don't
I'm here to serve the
good,
country.
But don't.
Well, that kind of public cursing, especially by someone with a high profile job, is shocking and unusual, to say the least. Most of us have used a swear word or two, and they can cover a range of emotions. Doing research for the show, we found a study that concluded that swearing is a sign of verbal fluency, that swearing can help you manage pain and can have a bonding effect on your relationships. On the other hand, some worry that the profusion of profanity is a sign of the coarsening of the culture. Today in Radio Times, why we use swear words, obviously not a show for everybody, especially for children. Joining us is Ben Zimmer. He's a linguist and lexicographer who writes the Word on the Street column for the Wall Street Journal. Ben Zimmer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Benjamin Bergen. He's a professor of cognitive science and director of the Language Cognition Lab at the University of California at San Diego. Wrote a book called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Benjamin Bergen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
So happy to speak with you.
So while we still have those words from Anthony Scaramucci in our ears here, Benjamin, what was your response to his tirade?
Well, I guess I wasn't that surprised. We know that people in lots of professions use profanity, and I think he believed that he was speaking off the record, or at least he didn't expect to be recorded. He's obviously a person who has lots of experience talking to subordinates. People behind closed doors. And we know that people in lots of professions use profanity. So I wasn't particularly surprised, actually.
How about for you, Ben?
Well, I agree that that it's probably not surprising if we were able to listen to the way that Anthony Scaramucci talks on a daily basis. That's probably it. What's surprising is that he was talking to a reporter who put it all out there for
yes.
us all to see.
Yes.
The clip that you played, I think, was from the New Yorker Radio Hour, which had to bleep everything because they also play that on, you know, public radio, which has rules about the words that you can say on air. But in print, it showed up in the New Yorker, and other publications like the New York Times followed suit. They said that this was newsworthy enough, and certainly it was, for those words to appear unexpurgated in print. That is an unusual thing, although in the case of the New York Times, for instance, they broke new ground just last October because of Donald Trump and the Access Hollywood tape, where there were obviously a lot of vulgar language there that ended up on the front page of the New York Times with no expurgation.
So this is the times that we live in, clearly. Benjamin, let me go back to you. You talked about how people talk to subordinates, and I was thinking if this had been a woman, I won't even give her a name, but if instead of Anthony Scaramucci we had heard a woman say the same thing, how do you think people would have responded to that?
There's good evidence that people's impressions of swearers differs as a function of their perceived sex and also the sex of the person making the judgment. In general, men tend to think that women swearing are breaking norms, that they're breaking the rules, the expected behaviors of women.
Even in 2017.
Even in 2017. Yeah, I mean, so there are studies that have been done in the last 5 or 10 years with college students that show these judgments. It's a little bit more complicated when you ask how do women judge women who swear. It seems to depend on the context. So there's some evidence that women in groups of women only swear about as much as men do in groups of men only, and that women perceiving other women to swear around women don't actually carry negative judgments about them.
So it's men who judge women who swear?
Right.
Does that make sense to you, Ben Zimmer?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, we often see these kind of gendered reactions when it comes to language like that. It's, you know, historically, it's very often been the case that, you know, these certain taboo words in our lexicon are seen as the province of men, and for so that when women dare to use these words, then it seems exceedingly scandalous. But, you know, again, that just has to do with the way that, you know, there are certain gender stereotypes when it comes to language, and this, you know, taboo use of language plays right into that.
I ran across a quote from Helen Mirren, who seems to revel in the fact that younger women feel empowered to be subversive and to also use profanity. And I also ran across, I mentioned that Judi Dench is known for subversive needlework. So you have two dames from England who seem very comfortable with using profanity. Ben Zimmer, any surprises there for you?
Well,
I don't know what to make of it.
It's wonderful that they have that perspective, and you know, perhaps because they are a sort of established women in acting, they're you know able to play with those boundaries a little more. But it's also a good observation that a lot of this may be generational, and right. So that younger women may not feel as hemmed in by expectations about the gendered use of language, and when it comes to using certain words that we can't say on the air, there may be some changes going on with younger generations.
We have two Bens, so that's Ben Zimmer. I'm now turning to Benjamin Bergen. Benjamin, are you a fan of swearing?
A fan. I would say that I'm a big fan of language in general, and there are certain things that you can do with swearing that you can't really do otherwise. So I'm a fan of the ability to express strong emotions. I'm a fan of the ability to create the sort of social cohesion, humor, and so on that you can with swearing. I'm not a fan of, you know, verbal abuse, and verbal abuse is oftentimes accompanied by swearing. And I guess I'm not a fan of denigrating people by their ethnicity or religion or sex, and that is something that you can do with profanity. So I guess I'm a fan of it like I'm a fan of nuclear power. There's some good stuff that it can do and some things that maybe you'd prefer it not be deployed for.
I didn't know you were going to go for that metaphor. Ben, where do you stand on profanity?
Oh, well, I agree with Benjamin Bergen about the way that profanity can you know very often be used to express genuine emotion for humorous purposes, while the flip side, the sort of the dark side, being this kind of verbal abuse. And so, you know, I can't say that I'm a fan of, for instance, you know, what Donald Trump was recorded saying on that Access Hollywood tape that we all heard.
Sure.
You know, as an example of more abusive language. But you know, it's something I think that we can revel in. There's you know plenty of excellent work that's being done these days on a scholarly level by Benjamin Bergen and others. There's a blog that I participate in, a group blog called Strong Language, where we just kind of immerse ourselves in all of this and you know, feel free to talk about all of this taboo language in an open way. And so I think there's an awful lot to dig into, and it tells us a lot about our language and our society just by looking at the way people use this kind of language and the reactions that kind of language engenders.
But Ben, are you saying that we need taboo language? We need profanity?
Do we need it?
We need it? Yeah. I mean, it's been around for, I don't know, centuries.
Right. And some of those taboos have been broken down in the past, you know, 50 years where we, you know, do have more public use of terms that previously would not be allowed, you know, in print or in other public venues. But, you know, I think the fact that we maintain these boundaries around these words, just the fact that, for instance, we can't, you know, actually state what words we're talking about
exactly.
On this radio program.
Exactly.
That maintains this kind of taboo aspect, which gives these words a kind of a magic or mystery to them, despite the fact that, you know, people complain that there's a coarsening of the culture. There's still something that seems off limits or provocative about these words. And I think, yes, there will always be a place for that in some form. Of course, the boundaries will change over time, and what's considered taboo now may not be in, you know, another few decades. But there will always be something like that, which serves as a kind of a transgressive or subversive force in the language.
Benjamin, do you think we need these words?
I think there's an ecological niche that they fit into. And just like when you look across continents, you know, you often find something that's like a raccoon. You often find something that's like a wolf that may have converged to that place. But then there may be times and places where you just don't find that particular creature. And I think it's kind of like that with language. There are functions that certain words can serve, and they're really useful for doing that particular thing, for eating, you know, nuts and berries or, you know, carcasses or whatever it is. But they don't necessarily have to always appear. And when you look across the languages and cultures of the world, you sometimes find that those languages and cultures don't have exactly the same attitude, the same perspective towards language. If you look at continental French, for example, yeah, there are bad words, but they're really not that bad. And they're so much not bad that you could see them. Well, for example, you could hear them on public radio, or you could see them on the 8 o'clock news, or you could hear them uttered by the president of the republic on the floor of the Senate. And those attitudes can change over time. It's quite possible that 100 years from now, although there will still be something like taboo words, the taboos just aren't quite as strong.
But in order to be taboo, it seems, Benjamin, these words have to have some kind of power to, if not shock, perhaps offend.
Right. Well, that's this cycle that Ben Zimmer was talking about, that the censorship itself is the thing that creates in the next generation of speakers, that creates in them the belief that there's something powerful and taboo about these words. As our mores start to shift, as we're less and less restrictive about how we use language around kids, what we tell them about how they can use language, how we punish them or specifically not for the language that they use, it's possible that we'll grow new generations of people who don't have quite as strong trained feelings about those words.
We are talking about those words, meaning swear words. Do they offend you? Do you use profanity? Are there places where profanity is off limits? How about kids using profanity? You can call our comment line or text us 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. The voice you heard, Benjamin Bergen. He's a professor of cognitive science, director of the Language Cognition Lab that's at the University of California at San Diego. Wrote a book called What the F? Also with us, Ben Zimmer. He's a linguist and lexicographer. He writes the On the Street column for the Wall Street Journal. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You see, we've learned something today. Swearing can be fun, but doing it all the time causes a lot of problems.
We're all saying the S word too much. The Knights of Standards and Practices were created to make sure that bad words were kept to a minimum. Curse words. They're called that because they are cursed. We have to go back to only using curse words in rare, extreme circumstances. And besides, too much use of a dirty word takes away from its impact. We believe in free speech and all that, but making a few words taboo just adds to the fun of English. So please, everyone, from now on, you've got to try and watch your language.
Words of wisdom from the kids from South Park. That's from a 2001 episode. Talking with Benjamin Bergen and Ben Zimmer about curse words. And again, you can join our conversation by calling our comment line or texting our comment line 267-405-2006. Ben, I wonder whether, I guess we should stick to the English language, whether there's something about curse words that have to do with bodily functions, have to do with sex, and I guess have to do with God. Why are these words considered taboo?
Right. Well, each language has its own, you know, set of taboo items, and it relates to, you know, various kinds of cultural taboos, the things that we find to be off limits. And, yeah, historically, in English, it was the religious ones that were seen, you know, of course, as profane. That literally means, you know, profaning God by using a language that was you know, taking God's name in vain, and various other things that were seen as impinging on the sacred in some way. In the last century or two, though, that has shifted to, you know, as you say, bodily functions, sex, and, you know, other things like that serve as the foundation of a lot of our taboo vocabulary. So it's, you know, it's something that changes over time. You know, the fact that saying something like "God damn" doesn't have the same impact that it would have a couple of centuries ago shows, in some ways, our changing perspective on the role of religion and, you know, taking the Lord's name in vain, that sort of thing. And so other things have taken their place. We do find the bodily functions are very, very often what we turn to. Not every language is going to work that way. That's a common source of a lot of this vocabulary.
And we call them, Benjamin Bergen, we call them dirty words, right?
That's right. Almost as if we were identifying the word with the thing in the world and our attitudes about it, right, that it refers to.
You've looked at the brain, I guess, sort of where cursing comes from in the brain. Is there a location there, Benjamin?
Well, there are differences in how we produce words depending on what we're doing with those words. And we know this because of what happens during certain types of aphasia. So aphasia is a disorder or set of disorders that are associated with damage to particular parts of the brain that run language. And a lot of people have experienced this or have family members or friends who have had strokes. It happens during Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury. Lots of things can cause aphasia. And what's been noticed for 150 years now is that even when people's ability to produce mundane, routine language, the sort of rational, intentional stuff that we're doing right now,
right,
even when that's impaired, oftentimes people with aphasia still have certain language functions preserved. And one of those is spontaneous profanity. Huh. So you'll find someone who can't put together three or four words. You know, they have a task. They're supposed to describe a picture to their doctor. They can't say the dog is chasing the cat. They'll struggle for a little bit, and then they'll swear. And the swears come out perfectly fluent and natural. And we've now been able to pin down exactly why this is. And it's because spontaneous production of profanity runs through a different pathway in the brain. Mm-hmm. It's not on the left hemisphere, as a lot of rational language is. It's not on the surface of the brain, like many of our evolutionarily new and complex and abstract abilities are, like language. It comes from deep in the heart of the brain, in a center that's responsible actually for selecting actions on the basis of emotions. It's something that we share with other primates, with other mammals. In fact, shrews have it, and so do lemurs, the basal ganglia. And it's responsible for that thing where you're experiencing some strong emotion, frustration, anger, elation, and you got to choose something to do. Do you fight? Do you flee? Do you screech? And in humans, we use that not just to do those things, but also to swear spontaneously.
And that's where those strong emotions come from. I'm also thinking that not everybody, but some people with Tourette's have, when the words come out, and I'll put this back to you, Benjamin Bergen, they can come out as swear words. Is that the same thing that you're talking about, or is that something different?
It involves the very same part of the brain. So we know that when people have Tourette's syndrome, some percentage of the time, somewhere between about 10% of the time and half of the time, they also have a verbal condition known as coprolalia. So this is actually not most people with Tourette's syndrome, but it's maybe the most visible part of it. Coprolalia is, exactly as you said, the uncontrollable production of taboo words and phrases. And it's actually quite challenging to live with coprolalia, of course, because it comes out most at the times when the person is experiencing the most stress or anxiety. And that's obviously when they're out in public in places where you wouldn't want to swear at all. And so this is caused by a difference in the basal ganglia, that part of the center of the brain that does this emotion tracking and action selection. differences in how people with Tourette syndrome have their basal ganglia organized compared with the rest of us.
Let me read a couple of email comments. One from Matt who says, would your guest care to discuss the differences across English language speakers? For example, the Brits seem to use more colorful phrases compared to Americans and perhaps Canadians too, who tend to use single word taboo. Ben Zimmer, I'm going to toss that to you. What do you think?
I think to some extent, speakers of British English do have traditions of colorful swearing that Americans find quite enticing sometimes. Sometimes this comes out, for instance, last year there was a lot of public swearing at Donald Trump, particularly when during the campaign he ended up at in Scotland right after the Brexit vote and basically made it sound as if Scotland was for Brexit when Scotland had voted against Brexit. And there was this great public outcry, and we heard on Twitter especially Scottish people using the most wonderful cursing to to address Mr. Trump. And Scotland in particular has this tradition of, I believe it's called slighting, S-L-Y-T-I-N-G, of a kind of ritual exchange of insults. And you see that in various other cultures as well. But yeah, certainly for, you know, for instance, Scottish English speakers, there's something sort of in the culture that really, you know, you try to one up each other with more and more colorful insults.
Well, colorful insults. We are talking about cursing in this hour of Radio Times. There's a lot of it. We certainly heard Anthony Scaramucci's tirade. He lost his job, I guess, in part because of that very public tirade. We are talking about the fact that most of us do curse. It has an interesting history, interesting linguistics as well. And again, you can join us by calling or texting our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with Ben Zimmer, he's a linguist and lexicographer, writes the Word on the Street column. He's also part of a blog called Strong Language, and he's executive editor for vocabulary.com and for the Visual Thesaurus. Benjamin Bergen, professor of cognitive science, director of the Language Cognition Lab, that's at the University of California at San Diego, wrote a book called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Our Selves. I wonder if I could go back to you, Benjamin Bergen, and then I've got a bunch of people that want to join our conversation here. I have to say, is there's more public swearing. You just hear it as you walk around in a restaurant, in a city, wherever. You're gonna hear it. What is more taboo now are racial slurs or ethnic slurs or gender slurs. That has basically taken the place of curse words when it comes to taboo. What do you think about that?
Well, we have pretty clear evidence that that's the case. If you survey people, say younger Americans, millennials on down, you find that they don't find the canonical taboo words, those words relating to sex or bodily functions or religion, they don't find them to be quite as offensive as previous generations did. So all those words on George Carlin's list of the seven words that you, or the extended list that you can't say on television or the radio, those don't really offend them so much. The F word on a recent survey shows up as number 13 or 14, I think.
Wow.
Among millennials. Yeah, the strongest words are words that are used to denigrate people by dint of their ethnicity or sex or religion and so on.
Do you hear more public swearing, Ben Zimmer?
Do I hear more public swearing? I don't know if people's actual swearing habits have changed all that much. Although, you know, again, it could be true that young people don't find their previous generation's taboo language as taboo as before. Does that mean that people are swearing more in public? Well, perhaps we're just exposed to it more through mass media, through TV shows, especially on HBO and other channels that don't have to worry about FCC regulations about swearing, as well as, movies and music and so forth. Certainly there's been a sea change since the 1960s, pretty much, in the use of swearing in popular culture, let's say. So while the barriers have changed in terms of mass media, I'm not sure if that necessarily correlates to, a huge uptick in swearing that people are doing just in their daily lives.
Let me read some email. One from Richard. He said it's not the usage of swear words. It's the rate of swear words in ordinary conversation that has the coarsening effect. And I think we know, Benjamin Bergen, what Richard is talking about. You can hear the F-bomb, every several words sometimes in people's conversation.
Well, I think Ben Zimmer is sort of hit the nail on the head, as it were. The democratization of media has proliferated casual language, informal language. What you get on your Twitter feed is just people reacting emotionally or not, but casually and informally to the day's events. And we previously weren't as exposed to that because the media that we had access to was all filtered through gatekeepers. And so that can have the effect of, it can have two effects. One, it can have the effect of the increased impression that profanity is all around us. And second, it can have the effect of decreasing the impact of those words. That's kind of what the South Park kids were getting at, right?
Right.
The more in that particular episode, I think they played a particular four-letter word some 100-150 times over the course of the half hour. And by the end, it didn't really have any impact at all. And that's the effect that we're seeing in survey data from younger Americans, where that same word, a word that starts with SH and has four letters, they judge to be less offensive than words like moist.
Is that a direct quote there, Benjamin Bergen?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. It shows up as number 50 on the particular survey that I'm thinking
of.
Oh,
and moist comes before that. Okay.
Mm-hmm, right.
An email from Steve. I'm fascinated how a word that's vulgar in one language can lose its power and even sound pleasant in another language. It speaks to the completely random abstract nature of sounds and words and the meanings we each bring to them as individuals and as a culture. Picking up on that, though, Ben Zimmer, I wonder whether there are certain sounds that are associated with swear words. Yes, no?
Well, it depends on the sort of the linguistic community you're talking about. And so for English speakers, there's a sound of monosyllables that are derived from Anglo-Saxon that have this kind of short, sharp sound to them that we associate with profanity, and that's why we call them four-letter words. They might not all be exactly four letters, but the idea that there are these short Germanic-derived words that have that particular force in English is something that's been accepted culturally. Of course, other languages will associate other types of sounds and other words depending on the sort of the history of those words and how they've become taboo in their languages. So we tend to kind of naturalize all of this based on what we know about our own native language. So we think, that must be how it is for everyone. And there may, again, be sort of universally, there may be sort of taboo lexical items in everybody's language. But the way that works out in terms of the way they sound and, again, what they mean, what they refer to, there's a lot of variation there.
Benjamin, what do you suggest? And I know your book isn't necessarily a how-to or a how-not-to, but what do you suggest for parents and kids and teaching them about language and what a curse word or a swear word, what that means?
Well, this is something that I've had to confront myself. I have a 3-year-old at home. As someone who uses casual language, including profanity in his everyday life, I've had to decide, am I going to censor myself around my kid, around my kid's friends, around my kid's friends' parents? Am I going to have conversations with my kid where we sit down and have a heart-to-heart with a 3-year-old about how language works? The decision that I've come to, just from looking at the evidence about profanity and what it does to kids, is that there's very little evidence that profanity by itself, you know, not verbal abuse, but profanity, you know, just like, hey, my basketball team won the championship this year. I'm excited. Here comes a four-letter word to express how excited I am. That type of profanity doesn't demonstrably harm kids in any way. The only deleterious effects you might expect is that the kid might then go out and use that word around his friends or teachers or his friends' parents, and that might have negative social consequences for him. But I've actually, you know, you can rationalize anything, and
sure.
I've sort of talked myself into the position that you know, kids don't really learn profanity much or taboo words in general from their parents. They don't really think that we're that cool. In general, kids learn profanity from other kids, particularly older kids or kids who have older siblings. And, you know, they are defining their language norms for their generation. They don't want to be so much like us as they want to be like their peer group. And there's some good anecdotal evidence that kids really just learn taboo language from other kids. So I've actually not censored myself so much. And so far, my kid doesn't really want to be like me, and he's not swearing at all.
Ben, you want to weigh in on this? We're almost having a break here, but your thoughts?
Yeah, I have a similar experience with my son, who's now 11. He's always been more prudish than me by far about taboo language. I want to make sure that he understands when it's appropriate to use words and when it's not. But he tends to want to just sort of bleep over anything that he considers a bad word, which I find, you know, kind of funny, because I try to be sort of accepting of, you know, the right language in the right place and time. He's still sort of thinking of all of these words as with a kind of a blanket idea that we shouldn't use them. But again, this is what kids learn over time, when it's appropriate to use words like this and when it's not.
You have a rebel for a child there, Ben Zimmer. We are talking about language. We are talking about curse words in particular, talking with Ben Zimmer and Benjamin Bergen. And again, you can... lots of comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. The comment line, 267-405-2006. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Most of us have used profanity to express a range of emotions, from surprise and shock to anger and awe. In fact, some swear words are used so often you wonder if they have lost their ability to shock. We're talking with Benjamin Bergen and also Ben Zimmer about profanity. And let me read a text from a New Jersey listener who said, when my son was four, he asked how come it was harmful for him to use swear words, but not for me to, since he heard me slip up from time to time. I couldn't give him a good answer, so I changed the rules, and since then I've allowed him to swear as long as he only does it in our home and only when we have no guests over. He's in third grade now, and so far it's worked out well. He doesn't overuse bad words at home or swear outside the house. So that's another parent weighing in on cursing and their children. Let me play Wade, who called into our comment line.
From Northeast Philadelphia. I have an 18-year-old teenage daughter, and over the last year or so, she seems to be feeling more comfortable about cursing in front of us. And just wondering then, in terms of age, when does it seem that line gets crossed where it's okay to have your teenage child cursing along with the parents?
I think we've hit a theme here, Benjamin Bergen. Do you want to weigh in on this? And using these words can be a sign or a form of rebellion, of trying to be cool, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we have a little bit of empirical evidence on this. There was a longitudinal study that was done with where researchers went out into the field and just marked down what kids were saying over the course of time, and found that early on, when kids produce what is sort of the form of profanity that will eventually emerge, they're saying things that are really not that profane. So they're calling people stupid or dummy and that kind of thing. And over time, it evolves in ways that you would naturally expect. I think that this is a question that really just comes down to what sort of parenting do you want to do. An 18-year-old is, of course, an adult, and I don't know you know, the specifics of the situation, whether she's still living in the house or so on. But definitely there are people who give more and more freedom and autonomy to kids depending on their values at different
sure.
ages. So there's some 14-year-olds who live in, you know, live above the garage and, you know, have their own entrance and can do whatever they want. So I think it really comes down to parenting style.
Ben, let me read an email from Russell. He says, maybe I'm hopelessly old-fashioned, but I've always considered runaway use of profanity to be a sign of a limited vocabulary. I quoted a study that said, no, it's a sign of verbal fluency. Is it both, or is it one or the other? Do we have definitive research on this?
I don't know about definitive research, but but in terms of it being some indicator of a limited vocabulary, I don't think that there's necessarily any correlation to that. We've already talked about how colorful cursing can be if done in a creative fashion, and that may rely on many of those taboo words that we can't say on the air, but used in a creative way. And, you know, as I mentioned with the Scottish Twitter reaction to Donald Trump, there are just endless possibilities of things that one could call someone. And it was fascinating to see a kind of an efflorescence of all of this creative cursing going on. So from my perspective, I don't see it as any sort of indicator of limited vocabulary. Now, of course, if you're hearing the same, you know, F-bombs being used in conversation without much variation, it may feel that way, where it's just a kind of a go-to word that's, you know, overused in that way. But even in that case, very often one single word like that will take on so many different shades of meaning depending on the context, depending on the situation and how it's deployed. So, you know, just looking at how one seemingly very simple word is used will show a great amount of variation in usage.
Benjamin Bergen, you can find research for anything, but here's something about cursing at work. 5 reasons why we really like people who curse at work from theladders.com. Not sure what it is. Breaking the rules creates a sense of solidarity. Cursing at work denotes honesty. People who curse may be smarter. Well-timed cursing adds humor to the workday. Cursing is persuasive. Do you have thoughts or opinions about cursing at work? And that's, of course, some people are our close colleagues. Some are your boss. Some are your underlings. Do you have a position on cursing at work?
Well, we know that people have cursed at certain types of work forever. I heard a great podcast about containers that Alexis Madrigal put together. And in it, he had tapes of longshoremen from, I think, the 50s in Oakland. And boy, that was not a G-rated workplace. and it's known that there are lots of professions that are like this. Stockbrokers report that there's been swearing there forever. Realtors have been marked as prolific swearers. Journalists actually end up being pretty high on the list of swearers in the workplace.
Not surprised.
Yeah, right. I didn't think so. But it's possible that those mores are changing now, as we've been talking about, as certain words that used to be very taboo are becoming less taboo. And that's a potential sticking point, right? If you have people in the workplace who have more conservative positions about language, who find taboo language to be inappropriate for the workplace, and you have perhaps younger people moving into the workplace who have different ideas, that's going to be a potential point of potential pain point.
Who decides that? I mean, is that an HR question? How much profanity we allow in the workplace?
Yeah, it's typically not. It's typically the stage is usually set from the top down. So what I've observed is that there are workplaces in which the people in charge, whoever that is, decide that they are going to use language casually, informal language, including profanity, and that kind of trickles down such that people who have a little bit less power judge it to be acceptable to use that language in that circumstance. But if you have a boss who's really careful with their language and doesn't use taboo words, then you're less likely to find that their subordinates are willing to transgress in that way.
Ben, it's interesting that these, you know, more traditional swear words are migrating into the culture. But are we getting new swear words, or are we stuck with the ones we have?
Well, I think there's always the possibility for new swear words, but what I've found over the past couple of years, including the Scottish insults that I mentioned from last year, that there's always an element in there that comes from our sort of traditional dirty words, but it's how you use them in combination. You can form new compounds out of them, or you can use some colorful adjective to go along with it. And so there's something in there that we identify as, one of our traditional swear words and therefore taboo, but it's the way that you create something new out of it. And we have all sorts of ways of doing that to sort of produce new compounds or new phrases and that sort of thing. And so I think that's where the real innovation lies in terms of what I've seen. And there's also this interesting thing that I think that Twitter and other social media sometimes encourages, where you see someone come up with a very funny insult and you want to see if you can do something along those same lines. And so, I think in some ways we're living in a golden age of cursing, because there's all sorts of creativity, and it's so much more available to us, as Benjamin Bergen was saying, because people can, let it all hang out on social media without worrying too much about the usual sort of propriety of the social restrictions on this language. That means that, they're spreading much more quickly. And if, someone comes up with something particularly, witty or colorful, that may, spread around the world within minutes.
Ben, I know that you deconstructed something that Pennsylvania State Senator Daylen Leach said earlier this year. We, again, can't say those words on the radio, but it seems like you were giving him some kudos for creativity.
Yes, that was the blank Gibbon insult that was being used for Trump. And yeah, that's another case where there's, a bad word that we can't say on the air was put into conjunction with the word Gibbon to create a new insult. And that one, as it turns out, goes back quite a ways. It was being used in a British music magazine back in the 1980s, believe it or not.
Wow.
But it has had this new life just since last year, being used directed towards Donald Trump. And so in some ways, the Trump era has been marked by this innovation, where very often it's people coming up with colorful ways to refer to Trump himself.
Let me read some more comments. A text from Doug. He says, I curse far less at the age of 69 than I did at 19. Nothing prudish. Maybe I'm just more conscious of how I appear to others. A text from Greg. Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn was once considered the most powerful line in a movie. Has language progressed, or is cussing the lowest common denominator? Is the F-bomb in music really art? Does it really rank up there with the language of Shakespeare and Wordsworth? I wonder, though, I don't know how much you have looked at Shakespeare, Benjamin Bergen, but can we give some credit to Shakespeare for helping us develop some of this language?
Well, this is going to be more Ben Zimmer's domain than mine, but it's certainly true that Shakespeare was both very creative with language and creative with taboo language and putting it into double entendres and so on. But maybe I'll pass the buck.
Fair enough. Go ahead, Ben Zimmer.
Yes, absolutely. Shakespeare, it's funny to hold Shakespeare up as someone who would never dare to use such language. He did in very often clever ways of using double entendres that his audience would get. Sometimes it's completely lost on us as modern readers or listeners of this language. But if you read like an annotated version, especially of the comedies, you'll find, oh my goodness, that's what that meant, or that was implied by this because it was pronounced similar to this other word that you couldn't say. And so Shakespeare was constantly having fun with that sort of thing. And he was writing, you know, to appeal to people in the vernacular, even though we think of it as the sort of high-flying poetic language now. Very often, especially with earthier characters in his comedies, there would be all sorts of wordplay going on that hinged on taboo language in some way.
Here's an email from Paul. He says, cursing shows anger. If you want to win the argument that led the other person to swear, stay cool, win with clarity and logic. But I get the feeling, Benjamin, that yes, it's a form of expressing anger, but it can also be awe and joy and surprise. I mean, these words are quite malleable.
That's right. They can do all kinds of things. And with respect to arguments, we actually have a little bit of data on this. So there was a cool study that came out about 10 years ago that played people two versions of someone making an argument, trying to persuade. And it was an argument about whether tuition rates should be lowered at another university somewhere else. And in those two versions, one had swearing, I think 3 or 4 swear words thrown in, and the other had no swearing at all. And the people who watched this video were asked to judge a number of things. How much does this person believe in this particular position that they're arguing for? And how much do you agree with their position? And what they found was that the swearing version of the video led viewers to say that speaker was not only more committed, not only more genuinely committed to the position that they were arguing, but also they were more convinced by the argument.
Oh, wow.
So in certain cases, profanity can actually move the needle.
Here's a text from a Delaware listener. My 80-year-old mother has reluctantly unfriended some of her beloved grandchildren on Facebook because she cannot bear even reading their overwhelming use of swear words on their part as well as their friends and peers. And that's, I think, sometimes the danger of having friends on Facebook. But it does raise a question, Ben, about if someone is offended by this language, who gets to decide?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question again, because we're often interacting with each other in new ways. So, you know, if someone uses language on Facebook and that's being transmitted to people who are of different ages, of different social backgrounds, and you may be offending someone somewhere. I mean, and so that makes it a lot trickier. I think when we're in a one-on-one, face-to-face interaction with someone, we're good at judging what is appropriate and what is not, and that can have to do with our power relations with that person, our sense of intimacy and familiarity, and whether it's appropriate to use a word or not. Again, whether we're, you know, in a workplace, that's where it's appropriate. But with new social media, that becomes more of a minefield, I would say, because, again, your audience is out there and you may not even be aware of how it's being received. And so that does get tricky, and I think it's always best to sort of err on the side of caution when you're not exactly sure who's going to be receiving those words.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Ben Zimmer, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Linguist and lexicographer. He writes the Word on the Street column for the Wall Street Journal. He's got a blog called Strong Language. Also executive editor for the Visual Thesaurus. Benjamin Bergen, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor of cognitive science, director of the Language Cognition Lab that's at the University of California at San Diego. Wrote a book called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. And our thanks for having an expletive deleted program here on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I should say, actually, expletive free. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.